Folks, you are listening to WGDR Plainfield, WGDH Hardwick, Central Vermont Community Radio on your dial at 91.1 FM and 91.7 FM if you're up towards the Northeast Kingdom. And hey guys, happy Saturday! Yay! The chickens are here, the ducks, the cows, the dogs, everybody's here in the station, and we are having another party. It's another episode of Amy's Kids Show, and it's Saturday morning, my favorite day of the week. And can I just tell you something really important? Community support for Amy's Kids Show is provided in part by Woodbury Mountain Toys, featuring a selection of toys and games for kids of all ages. Located at 24 State Street in Montpelier, Vermont, more information about Woodbury Mountain Toys can be found at woodburymountaintoys.com. Come in and play with us. Hey guys, I love that. Come in and play with us. That's perfect. That's exactly what we're doing here on Amy's Kids Show. And boy, for the past several weeks, we have been learning about our brains. About our brains, human brains, and what makes them so special. Well, let's do a little quiz and see if everybody's up to date here. Where is your brain? Do you have a brain? Where do you keep it? Is it in your elbow? Is it in your big toe? No, come on. Okay, I'm just joking, right? No, of course. Our brains are in our heads, and we've been learning about the parts of the brain, the three parts of the brain that are super important to understand how we work. Right? I mean, if you have a bicycle, it's interesting to know how it works, right? Well, we have this amazing body. And how does it work? Well, the more we know, right, the more we can grow, the more we can help ourselves grow. And we've been reading this wonderful story called A Wrinkle in Time by Madeline L'Engle. We are now on chapter 7. Oh, I love the drum roll there because that is perfect. We have crossed the middle of the book. We are now on the other half, and we're getting towards the end. We have about 5 chapters left to go, and today we're going to read chapter 5. And we're going to keep learning about brains, because brains are a little bit like the rest of our body, right? It really depends on what we feed our brain, right? You are what you eat. Have you heard of that saying before? You are what you eat. That's because we build our body out of the food we eat. Well, we have to be careful that we don't eat too much bad things, right? We want to eat good, healthy things too, and lots of those, so that we can grow a healthy body. Well, our brains are the same way. We have to be careful what we feed them. And how do we feed our brains? Why, we feed them by what we pay attention to. So we're going to be learning about paying attention and choosing, learning to choose what we feed our brain. That's part of growing up. Thank you for joining me, guys. Let's keep growing and learning and having fun. Happy Saturday. Let's dance.
You do the hokey pokey. You do the hokey pokey.
Girls and boys, this time we're going to do a song about two little blackbirds. You know, all of these songs and rhymes that we do with counting will help us to learn our numbers better. Now, this is about two of them. Now, let's raise our pointing fingers. And then we're going to shake these fingers so we have a lot of rhythm as we play. Now, it goes like this. Two little blackbirds sitting on a hill. One. Now, someone said a wall. We haven't come to that part. So let's just start with hill. Listen to me for just a little bit, all right? Two little blackbirds sitting on a hill. One's named Jack and the other's named Jill. Now put your finger, fly away, Jack. Now put your finger in back of your whole hand. Then fly away, Jill. That's right. Fly, come back, Jack. That's right. Bring your hands back again. Come back, Jill. Now use your pointing fingers and shake them again. Then two little blackbirds sitting on a hill. One named Jack and the other's named Jill. All right, now you sing it to me this time.
Two little blackbirds sitting on a wall.
Hill.
Jack and the other's named Jill.
Fly away, Jack. That's right.
Fly away, Jill. Come back, Jack. Come back, Jill. Two little blackbirds sitting on a hill.
Now, I noticed that, you know, we had sung another version of this, and we used two other names, two little blackbirds sitting on a wall named, one name's Peter and the other's name what?
Paul.
All right, let's sing that version, all right. Two little blackbirds sitting on a wall, one's named Peter and the other's named Paul. Fly away, Peter, fly away, Paul. Come back, Peter, come back, Paul. Two little blackbirds sitting on a wall. One's named Peter and the other's named Paul. All right, fine. Now, girls and boys, when I hold my hands out like this and then I ball them up real tightly, what are they now?
Fists.
These are fists, that's right. Now we're gonna play this little game of counting again, and it's called one potato, two potato. Now what you do is take your fist and you put one on top of the other and you keep changing back and forth again, all right? So it's one potato, two potato, three potato, four, five potato, six potato, seven potato more. All right, now this time we'll do it just a little faster. One potato, two potato, three potato, four, five potatoes, six potatoes, seven potatoes, more. Now this time we're going to reach almost to the sky, but just gradually. We'll go up and keep changing our fists back and forth, but go all the way up to the ceiling, all right? One potato, two potato, three potato, four, five potatoes, six potatoes, seven potatoes, more. Oh boy, you're stretching all the way up there. Now we've got to bring them down again. So one potato, two potato, three potato, four, five potatoes, six potatoes, seven potatoes, more. And sometime when you play this game, you can have several people play it, but each person has a chance to put his fists on top of the other, and you keep stacking them. All right, let's check it once through again. All right. One potato, two potato, three potato, four, five potato, six potato, seven potato, more. How fast can you go? One potato, two potato, three potato, four, five potato, six potato, seven potato, more. Fine.
Now, do what the song says to do. Do what the song says to do. Put your finger in the air, in the air. Put your finger in the air, in the air. Put your finger in the air. Tell me how was the air up there. Put your finger in the air and in the air. Now, put your finger on your chin and on your chin. On your chinny, 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 chin, chin, chin. With a beard on it, put your finger on your chin. That's where the soup slips in. Put your finger on your chin and on your chin. Now put your finger on your nose and on your nose. On your rosy, rosy, nosy, nosy nose. Put your finger on your nose. That's where the cold wind blows. Choo! Put your finger on your nose and on your nose. Now put your finger on your cheek and on your cheek. On your cheek, 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 cheekity, cheek, cheek, cheek. Put your finger on your cheek and leave it about a week. Put your finger on your cheek and on your cheek. Now put your finger on your head and on your head. On your hairy, hairy, very hairy head, just like mine. Put your finger on your head, tell me, is it green or red? Put your finger on your head and on your head. Now, put your finger on your finger, on your finger, you're allowed to use two. Put your finger on your finger, on your finger, you're allowed to use three. Put your finger on your finger, and there let it linger. Put your finger on your finger, on your finger. Now, now you have to pretend that whoever's sitting next to you, if they're really not there, is your mom or your daddy. If they're really there, you don't have to pretend. But if they're not there, just pretend that whoever's sitting next to you is your mommy or daddy. Now, put your finger on your daddy or mommy, on your daddy or mommy. Put your finger on your daddy or mommy, on your daddy or mommy. Put your finger on your daddy or mommy. Tell them it's getting very late in the morning, you're getting very hungry, you want a great big fat sandwich made out of strawberries and salami. With mustard. Pickles and mud pies. Put your finger on your daddy or mommy. Put it down, down, down.
Well, folks, do you still have your finger on your cheek? You were supposed to leave it there for a week, right? Oh, my goodness. Isn't that a fun song? I love that song. Were you paying attention? Were you able to follow the directions? Good for you. But some of us probably chose not to follow all the directions, right? Like, I don't still have my finger on my cheek. How did I decide whether I was going to keep it there for a week or not? Well, that's about learning to choose what we feed our brains, learning to choose what we pay attention to. And that's what humans are always doing. We are learning more and more every day. And we use our powerful human brains in order to do that, of course. That's how we can make more wise choices as we go along. Because, well, of course, we have a reptile brain at the base of our skull that wants to keep us alive, and it's always looking for yummy things to eat and warm places to stay, you know, and danger and keeping us alive and things. And so that part of our brain has all kinds of things that it would like to choose, right? But it takes maturity. It's part of growing up. And that's how we learn to use our thinking brain instead of always listening to our reptile brain. We need to think it over and think about time and think about meaning and think about things we've learned before. And so that's the part of our brain, the thinking brain, that we use for all of that. I have a good example. Like, does anybody know a little child, right, that's going out to play in the snow? Right? And you go to put that winter coat and snow pants on them. And what do they say? Well, even starting around 2 years old, what is the most powerful word in the universe that kids usually learn by the time they're two? Does anybody know it? It's got two letters. The word no, right? Have you ever tried to put a snowsuit on a child in a nice warm house and they decide to say no? Well, of course, because their reptile brain is going, what are you talking about? I am plenty warm. I don't need to put that snowsuit on. If I put it on in here, I'm going to get hot. But our job, right, as the helper for the little child, that's why we don't let little children make those kinds of decisions, right? We need to help them understand that, well, honey, while it's warm in here, as soon as we go out that door, it's going to be very cold and you're going to wish you had your snowsuit on. And so, you know, that's because when we're young, our thinking brains aren't working yet. It takes years and years and years of practice to get that thinking brain working and learning and understanding enough so that we can think ahead. and picture what's going to happen in a few minutes when I step out that door, and remember what happened last time I went out without my coat on, right? And think about the temperature and how cold it is and how much warmer it is in the house because we have heat in the house and we don't have heat outside. And oh my goodness, I mean, some of us think that kind of thinking is easy, but guess what? It's not. It takes a long time to learn how to do that. So we don't always want to listen to our reptile brain about things, right? Sometimes we really want to listen to our thinking brain. And so this story, Wrinkle in Time, that we've been reading is what's called a coming of age story because it's really helping people come of age and grow up and mature into that thinking brain area. So some folks out there listening may be a little young. I mean, this book is really probably for about sixth graders on up, I would say. Sometimes younger folks, you know, like Charles Wallace in the story, he's very young, but his thinking brain is already pretty mature. But as we're about to find out, not mature enough because he's still very young and he just doesn't have that experience and practice using it. And he's going to learn a lot in the story. And so is everybody. And so are you. And so am I. I'm learning a lot. So here we go. A Wrinkle in Time by Madeline L'Engle. Choosing what to pay attention to is what I call this chapter. But this is called The Man with Red Eyes. Okay. And it is... it's the dangerous part. So this is like the exciting part of the story. Here we go. And where we left off in the last chapter was Meg and her brother Charles Wallace and their friend Kelvin are about to walk into the central intelligence agency on the planet Cosmos. And Kelvin is just saying, I have a feeling we're going into terrible danger. Chapter 7, The Man with the Red Eyes. We knew that we were going to be in danger, Charles Wallace said. Mrs. What's-It told us that. Yes, and she told us that it was going to be worse for you than for Meg and me, and that you must be careful, Charles Wallace. You stay right here with Meg, old sport, and let me go in and case the joint and then report to you. No, Charles Wallace said firmly. She told us to stay together. She told us not to go off by ourselves. She told you not to go off by yourself, but I'm the oldest and I should go in first, said Kelvin. No, Meg's voice was flat. Charles is right, Cal. We have to stay together. Suppose you didn't come out and we had to go in after you. Come on. But let's hold hands, if you don't mind. Holding hands, they crossed the square. The huge central intelligence building had only one door, but it was an enormous one, at least two stories high and wider than a room, made of a dull, bronze-like material. Do we just knock? Meg giggled. Kelvin studied the door. There is not any handle or knob or latch or anything. Maybe there's another way to get in. Let's try knocking anyhow, Charles said. He raised his hand, but before he touched the door, it slid up from the bottom and to each side, splitting into three sections that had been completely invisible a moment before. The startled children looked into a great entrance hall of dull, greeny marble. Marble benches lined three of the walls. People were sitting there like statues. The green of the marble reflecting on their faces made them look bilious. They turned their heads as the door opened, saw the children, and looked away again. Come on, Charles said, still holding hands. They stepped in. As they crossed the threshold, the door shut silently behind them. Meg looked at Kelvin and Charles, and they, like the waiting people, were a sickly green. The children went up to the blank fourth wall. It seemed unsubstantial, as though one might almost be able to walk through it. Charles put out his hand. It's solid and icy cold. Kelvin touched it too. Ugh. Meg's left hand was held by Charles, her right hand by Kelvin, and she had no desire to let go either of them to touch that wall. Let's ask somebody something. Charles led them over to one of the benches. Could you tell us what's the procedure around here? He asked one of the men. The men all wore nondescript business suits. And though their features were as different from one another as the features of men on Earth, there was also a sameness to them. Like the sameness of people riding on a subway, Meg thought. Only on a subway, every once in a while, there's somebody different. And here, there isn't. The man looked at the children warily. The procedure for what? How do we see whoever's in authority? Charles asked. You present your papers to the A machine. You ought to know that, the man said severely. Where is the A machine? Kelvin asked. The man pointed to the blank wall. But there isn't a door or anything, Kelvin said. How do we get in? You put your S papers in the B slot, the man said. Why are you asking me these stupid questions? Do you think I don't know the answers? You'd better not play any games around here, or you'll have to go through the process machine again. And you don't want to do that. We're strangers here, Kelvin said. That's why we don't know about things. Please tell us, sir, who you are and what you do. I run a number one spelling machine on the second grade level. But what are you doing here now? Charles Wallace asked. I am here to report that one of my letters is jamming, and until it can be properly oiled by an F-grade oiler, there is danger of jammed mines. Strawberry jam or raspberry? Charles Wallace murmured. Kelvin looked down at Charles and shook his head warningly. Meg gave the little boy's hand a slight, understanding pressure. Charles Wallace, she was quite sure, was not trying to be rude or funny. It was sort of his way of whistling in the dark. The man looked at Charles sharply. I think I shall have to report you. I'm fond of children, due to the nature of my work, and I don't like to get them in trouble, but rather than run the risk of reprocessing, I must report you. Maybe that's a good idea, Charles said. Who do you report us to? To whom do I report you? Well, to whom, then? I'm not in the second grade level yet. I wish he wouldn't act so sure of himself, Meg thought, looking anxiously at Charles and holding his hand more and more tightly until he wriggled his fingers in protest. That's what Mrs. What's-It said he had to watch, being proud. Don't, please don't, she thought hard at Charles Wallace. She wondered if Kelvin realized that a lot of the arrogance was just bravado. The man stood up, moving jerkily as though he had been sitting for a long time. I hope he isn't too hard on you, he murmured as he led the children toward the empty fourth wall. But I've been reprocessed once, and that was more than enough. And I don't want to get sent to it. I've never been sent to it, and I can't risk having that happen. There was it again. What was this it? The man took from his pocket a folder filled with papers of every color. He shuffled through them carefully, finally withdrawing one. I've had several reports to make lately. I shall have to ask for a requisition for more A21 cards. He took the card and put it against the wall. It slid through the marble, as though it were being sucked in and disappeared. You may have to be detained for a few days, the man said, but I'm sure they won't be too hard on you because of your youth. Just relax and don't fight it, and it will all be much easier for you. He went back to his seat, leaving the children standing and staring at the black, blank wall. And suddenly, the wall was no longer there, and they were looking into an enormous room lined with machines. They were not unlike the great computing machines Meg had seen in her science books and that she knew her father sometimes worked with. Some did not seem to be in use. In others, lights were flickering on and off. In one machine, a long tape was being eaten. In another, a series of dot dashes were being punched. Several white-robed attendants were moving about, tending the machines. If they saw the children, they gave no sign. Kelvin muttered something. What? Meg asked him. There is nothing to fear except fear itself, Kelvin said. I'm quoting, like Mrs. Who. Meg, I'm scared stiff. So am I. Meg held his hand more tightly. Come on. They stepped into the room with the machines. In spite of the enormous width of the room, it was even longer than it was wide. Perspective made the long rows of machines seem almost to meet. The children walked down the center of the room, keeping as far from the machines as possible. Though I don't suppose they're radioactive or anything, Charles Wallace said, or that they're going to reach out and grab us and chew us up. After they had walked for what seemed like miles, they could see that the enormous room did have an end, and that at the end, there was something. Charles Wallace said suddenly, and his voice held panic, "Don't let go of my hands. Hold me tight. He's trying to get at me." "Who?" Meg squeaked. "I don't know, but he's trying to get in at me. I can feel him." "Let's go back," Kelvin started to pull away. "No," Charles Wallace said. "I have to go on. We have to make decisions, and we can't make them if they're based on fear." His voice sounded old and strange and remote. Meg, clasping his small hand tightly, could feel it sweating in hers. As they approached the end of the room, their steps slowed. Before them was a platform. On the platform was a chair, and on the chair was a man. What was there about him that seemed to contain all the coldness and darkness they had felt as they plunged through the black thing on their way to this planet? "I have been waiting for you, my dears," the man said. His voice was kind and gentle, not at all the cold and frightening voice Meg had expected. It took her a moment to realize that though the voice came from the man, he had not opened his mouth or moved his lips at all, and no real words had been spoken to fall upon her ears, that he had somehow communicated directly into their brains. "But how does it happen that there are three of you?" the man asked. Charles Wallace spoke with harsh boldness, but Meg could feel him trembling. "Oh, Kelvin came along for the ride." "Oh, he did he?" For a moment, there was a sharpness to the voice that spoke inside their minds. Then it relaxed and became soothing again. "I hope that it has been a pleasant one so far."
"Very educational," Charles Wallace said.
"Let Kelvin speak for himself," the man ordered.
Kelvin growled, his lips tight, his body rigid. "I have nothing to say." Meg stared at the man in horrified fascination. His eyes were bright and had a reddish glow. Above his head was a light, and it glowed in the same manner as the eyes, pulsing, throbbing, in steady rhythm. Charles Wallace shut his eyes tightly. "Close your eyes," he said to Meg and Kelvin. "Don't look at the light. Don't look at his eyes. He'll hypnotize you."
"Clever, aren't you? Ha ha. Well, focusing your eyes would, of course, help," the soothing voice went on. "But there are other ways, my little man. Yes, there are other ways."
"If you try it on me, I shall kick you," Charles Wallace said. It was the first time Meg had ever heard Charles Wallace suggesting violence.
"Oh, you will indeed, my little man." The thought was tolerant, amused. But four men in dark smocks appeared and flanked the children.
"Now, my dears," the words continued, "I shall, of course, have no need of recourse to violence, but I thought perhaps it would save you the pain if I showed you at once that it would do you no good to try to oppose me. You see, what you will soon realize is that there is no need to fight me. Not only is there no need, but you will not have the slightest desire to do so. Why, you shall wish to fight someone. Why should you wish to fight someone who is here
only to save you pain and trouble. For you, as well as for the rest of all the happy, useful people on this planet, I, in my own strength, am willing to assume all the pain, all the responsibility, all the burdens of thought and decision. We will make our own decisions, thank you, Charles Wallace said. But of course, and our decisions will be one, yours and mine. Don't you see how much better, how much easier for you that is? Let me show you. Let us say the multiplication table together. No, Charles Wallace said. Once one is one. Once two is two. Once three is three. Mary had a little lamb, Charles Wallace shouted. Its fleece was white as snow. Once four is four. Once five is five. Once six is six. And everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go. Once seven is seven. Once eight is eight. Once nine is nine. Peter, pumpkin eater, had a wife and couldn't keep her. Once 10 is 10. Once 11 is 11. Once 12 is 12. The number words pounded insistently against Meg's brain. They seemed to be boring their way into her skull. Twice 2 is 2. Twice 2 is 4. Twice 3 is 6. Kelvin's voice came out in an angry shout. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Twice 4 is 8. Twice 5 is 10. Twice 6 is 12. Father! Meg screamed. Father! The scream, half involuntary, jerked her mind back out of the darkness. The words of the multiplication table seemed to break up into laughter. Ha ha ha, splendid, splendid. You have passed your preliminary tests with flying colors. You didn't think we were as easy as all that, falling for that old stuff, did you? Charles Wallace demanded. I hoped not. I most sincerely hoped not. But after all, you are very young and very impressionable. And the younger the better, my little man, the younger the better. Meg looked up at the fiery eyes, at the light pulsing above them, and then away. She tried looking at the mouth, at the thin, almost colorless lips. And this was more possible, even though she had to look obliquely, so that she was not sure exactly what the face really looked like, whether it was young or old, cruel or kind, human or alien. If you please, she said, trying to sound calm and brave, the only reason we are here is because we think our father is here. Can you tell us where to find him? Ah, your father! There seemed to be a great chortling of delight. Ah, yes, your father. It is not can I, you know, young lady, but will I? Will you, then? That depends on a number of things. Why do you want to see your father? Didn't you ever have a father yourself? Meg demanded. You don't want him for a reason. You want him because he's your father. Ah, but he hasn't been acting very like a father lately, has he? Abandoning his wife and his four little children to go gallivanting off on wild adventures of his own? He was working for the government. He'd never have left us otherwise. And we want to see him, please, right now. Ah, my little miss is impatient. Patience, patience, young lady. Meg did not tell the man on the chair that patience was not one of her virtues. And by the way, my children, he continued blandly, you don't need to vocalize verbally with me, you know. I can understand you quite as well as you can understand me. Charles Wallace put his hands on his hips defiantly. "The spoken word is one of the triumphs of man," he proclaimed, "and I intend to continue using it, particularly with people I don't trust." But his voice was shaking. Charles Wallace, who even as an infant had seldom cried, was near tears. "And you don't trust me?" the man asked. "What reason have you given us to trust you?" "What cause have I given you for distrust?" the man asked. The thin lips curled slightly. Suddenly, Charles Wallace darted forward and hit the man as hard as he could, which was fairly hard, as he had a good deal of coaching from his twin brothers. "Charles!" Meg screamed. The men in the dark smocks moved smoothly but with swiftness to Charles. The man in the chair casually raised one finger, and the men dropped back. "Hold it," Kelvin whispered, and together he and Meg darted forward and grabbed Charles Wallace, pulling him back from the platform. The man gave a wince, and the thought of his voice was a little breathless, as though Charles Wallace's punch had succeeded in winding him.
"Whew, may I ask why you did that?"
"Because you aren't you," Charles said. I'm not sure what you are, but you," he pointed to the man on the chair, "aren't what's talking to us. I'm sorry if I hurt you. I didn't think you were real. I thought perhaps you were a robot because I don't feel anything coming directly from you. I'm not sure where it's coming from, but it's coming through you. It isn't you." "Pretty smart, aren't you?" the thought asked, and Meg had an uncomfortable feeling that she detected a snarl. "It's not that I'm smart," Charles Wallace said, and again, Meg could feel the palm of his hand sweating inside hers. "Try to find out who I am, then," the thought probed. "I have been trying," Charles Wallace said, his voice high and troubled. "Look into my eyes, look deep within them, and I will tell you." Charles Wallace looked quickly at Meg and Kelvin, then said, as though to himself, "I have to," and focused his clear blue eyes on the red ones of the man in the chair. Meg looked not at the man, but at her brother. After a moment, it seemed that his eyes were no longer focusing. The pupils grew smaller and smaller, as though he were going into an intensely bright light, until they seemed to close entirely, until his eyes were nothing but an opaque blue. He slipped his hands out of Meg's and Calvin's and started walking slowly toward the man on the chair.
"No!" Meg screamed. "No!"
But Charles Wallace continued his slow walk forward, and she knew that he had not even heard her.
"No!" she screamed again and ran after him. With her inefficient flying tackle, she landed on him. She was so much larger that he had fell sprawling, hitting his head with a sharp crack against the marble floor. She knelt by him, sobbing. After a moment of lying there, as though he had been knocked out by the blow, he opened his eyes, shook his head, and sat up. Slowly, the pupils of his eyes dilated until they were back to normal, and the blood came back to his white cheeks. The man on the chair spoke directly into Meg's mind, and now there was a distinct menace to the words.
"I am not pleased," he said to her. "I could very easily lose my patience with you, and for that, for your information, young lady, would not be good for your father. If you have the slightest desire to see your father again, you had better cooperate."
Meg reacted as she sometimes reacted to Mr. Jenkins, the principal at school. She scowled down at the ground in sullen fury.
"It might help if you gave us something to eat," she complained. "We're all starved. If you're going to be horrible to us, then you might as well give us full stomachs first."
In case you guys listening don't remember, the kids are very hungry, actually. They haven't eaten since they left Earth a while ago and had some stew with Mrs. Murray. So they're hungry. Here we go. Again, the thoughts coming at her broke into laughter.
Oh, isn't she the funny girl, though? It's lucky for you that you amuse me, my dear, or I shouldn't be so easy on you. The boys I find not so nearly diverting. Ah, well, now tell me, young lady, if I feed you, will you stop interfering with me?
No, Meg said.
Starvation does work wonders, of course, the man told her. I hate to use such primitive methods on you, but of course you realize that you force them on me.
I wouldn't eat your old food anyhow.
Meg was still all churned up and angry, as though she were in Mr. Jenkins' principal's office.
I wouldn't trust your food.
Of course, our food, being synthetic, is not superior to your messes of beans and bacon and so forth, but I assure you that it's far more nourishing, and though it has no taste of its own, a slight conditioning is all that is necessary to give you the illusion that you are eating a roast turkey dinner.
If I ate now, I'd throw up anyhow, Meg said.
Still holding Meg's and Kelvin's hands, Charles Wallace stepped forward.
Okay, what next? He asked the man on the chair. We've had enough of these preliminaries. Let's get on with it.
That's exactly what we are doing, the man said. Until your sister interfered by practically giving you a brain concussion. Shall we try again?
No, Meg cried. No, Charles, please, let me do it, or Kelvin.
But it is only the little boy whose neurological system is complex enough. If you tried to conduct the necessary neurons, your brain would explode.
And Charles's wouldn't?
I think not.
But there's a possibility.
There's always a possibility.
Then he mustn't do it, Meg said.
I think you will have to grant him the right to make his own decisions, the man said.
But Meg, with the dogged tenacity that had so often caused her trouble, continued.
You mean Kelvin and I can't know who you really are?
Oh, no, I didn't say that. You can't know it in the same way, nor is it as important for me to have you know.
Ah, here we are.
From somewhere in the shadows appeared four more men in dark smocks carrying a table. It was covered with a white cloth, like the tables used by room service in hotels, and held a metal box containing something that smelled delicious, something that smelled like turkey dinner.
There's something phony in the whole setup, Meg thought, and there is definitely something rotten in the state of Kamazots.
Again, the thought seemed to break into laughter.
Of course, it doesn't really smell, but isn't it as good as though it really did?
The man's voice said.
I don't smell anything, Charles Wallace said.
I know, young man, and think how much you're missing. This will all taste to you as though you were eating sand. But I suggest that you force it down. I would rather not have your decisions come from the weakness of an empty stomach.
The table was set up in front of them, and the dark-smocked men heaped their plates with turkey and dressing and mashed potatoes and gravy and little green peas with big yellow blobs of butter melting in them and cranberries and sweet potatoes topped with gooey browned marshmallows and olives and celery and rosebud radishes and... Meg felt her stomach rumbling loudly. The saliva came to her mouth. Oh, my goodness, readers, mine is too, just reading this. Okay, I'm sorry.
Oh, Jiminy, Kelvin mumbled.
Chairs appeared, and the four men who had provided the feast slid back into the shadows. Charles Wallace freed his hands from Meg and Kelvin and plunked himself down on one of the chairs.
Come on, he said. If it's poisoned, it's poisoned, but I don't think it is.
Kelvin sat down. Meg continued to stand indecisively.
Kelvin took a bite.
He chewed. He swallowed. He looked at Meg.
If this isn't real,
It's the best imitation you'll ever get. Charles Wallace took a bite, made a face, and spit out his mouthful. It's unfair, he shouted at the man. Laughter again. Oh, go on, little fellow. Eat. Meg sighed and sat. I don't think we should eat this stuff, but if you're going to, I'd better too. She took a mouthful. It tastes all right. Try some of mine, Charles. She held out a forkful of turkey. Charles Wallace took it, made another face, but managed to swallow. Still tastes like sand, he said. He looked at the man. Why?
You know perfectly well why. You've shut your mind entirely to me. The other two can't. I can get in through the chinks. Not all the way in, but enough to give them a turkey dinner. You see, I'm really just a kind, jolly old gentleman.
Ha, Charles Wallace said. The man lifted his lips into a smile, and his smile was the most horrible thing Meg had ever seen.
Why don't you trust me, Charles? Why don't you trust me enough to come in and find out who I am? I am peace and utter rest. I am freedom from all responsibility. To come in to me is the last difficult decision you need ever make.
If I come in, can I get out again? Charles Wallace asked.
But of course, if you want to. But I don't think you will want to.
If I come, not to stay, you understand, just to find out about you, will you tell us where Father is?
Yes, yes, that is a promise, and I don't make promises lightly.
Can I speak to Meg and Kelvin alone, without you listening in? Charles Wallace asked.
No, the man said.
Charles shrugged. Listen, he said to Meg and Kelvin, I have to find out what he really is. You know that. I'm going to try to hold back. I'm going to try to keep a part of myself out. You mustn't stop me this time, Meg.
But you won't be able to, Charles. He's stronger than you are. You know that.
I have to try.
But Mrs. What's-It warned you.
Meg pleaded. I have to try. For Father, Meg, please, I want to know my father. For a moment, his lips trembled. Then he was back in control.
But it isn't only Father, Meg. You know that now. It's the black thing. We have to do what Mrs. Witch sent us to do.
Kelvin, Meg begged. But Kelvin shook his head. He's right, Meg. And we'll be with him, no matter what happens.
But what's going to happen? Meg cried.
Charles Wallace looked up at the man. Okay, he said. Let's go. Now the red eyes and the light above seemed to bore into Charles. And again, the pupils of the little boy's eyes contracted. When the final point of black was lost in blue, he turned away from the red eyes, looked at Meg, and smiled sweetly. But the smile was not Charles Wallace's smile.
Come on, Meg, eat this delicious food that has been prepared for us, he said.
Come on, Meg, eat this delicious food that has been prepared for us, he said. Meg snatched Charles Wallace's plate and threw it on the floor so that the dinner splashed about and the plate broke into fragments.
No, she cried, her voice rising shrilly. No, no, no!
From the shadows came one of the dark-smocked men and put another plate in front of Charles Wallace. And he began to eat eagerly.
What's wrong, Meg? Charles Wallace asked. Why are you being so belligerent and uncooperative?
The voice was Charles Wallace's voice, and yet it was different, too, somehow flattened out, almost as a voice might have sounded on the two-dimensional planet.
Meg grabbed wildly at Kelvin, shrieking, "That isn't Charles! Charles is gone!"
the end of chapter 7. Wow, guys, that's another cliffhanger that we're leaving ourselves with here. That's the end of chapter 7. We will continue with chapter 8. And don't worry, Charles Wallace is not gone. They will get him back. And so we're going to continue on. Now, the story, in case you didn't learn a couple of tricks, we can pay attention. We can also not pay attention. So I've replayed Put Your Finger in the Air, a different version now by Mark Dvorak. And let's see if we can not follow the directions. What do you say? Do you think that would be harder or easier? So we're going to give this a try, guys. See if you can not follow the directions this time, or follow the directions, whatever you want. You choose. It's your right. Here we go, guys. Put your finger in the air, in the air.
Finger in the air, in the air. Put your finger in the air, in the air. Put your finger in the air, leave it there about a year. Put your finger in the air, in the air. Now put your finger on your head, on your head. Put your finger on your head, on your head. Put your finger on your head, tell me, is it brown or red? Put your finger on your head, on your head. Now put your finger on your nose, on your nose. Put your finger on your nose, on your nose. Put your finger on your nose, leave it there till the warm wind blows. Put your finger on your nose, now put your finger on your cheek, and put your finger on your cheek. Put your finger on your cheek, leave it there about a week. Put your finger on your cheek, and put your finger on your chin, and put your finger on your chin. Put your finger on your chin, that's where the food slips in. Put your finger on your chin. Now put your finger on your belly, and put your finger on your belly. Put your finger on your belly, tell me, does it shake like jelly? Put your finger on your belly. Now put your finger on your shoe, put your finger on your shoe. Put your finger on your shoe, leave it there a month or two. Put your finger on your shoe, and put your finger on your friend, put your finger on your friend, put your finger on your friend, leave it there till this song ends. Put your finger on your friend, and put your finger in the air, put your finger in the air. Put your finger in the air, leave it there about a year. Put your finger in the air
of ants in the front yard under his tree. He got a bucket of water, he brought it over and he got down on his knees. He held the bucket of water over the anthill. He said, listen, all of you ants, if you don't want to drown, get yourselves out of town, 'cause I'm giving you one last chance. Jamie said,
listen to me, you better do what I say, if you know what is good for you.
'Cause if you don't, if you won't, why, there's no telling what I might do. Door opened up, Jamie's dad came out. He said, what are you doing out here? Get yourself back inside before I tan your hide. Do I make myself perfectly clear? Said, Dad. His dad said, enough. Don't talk back to me. Don't be rude. I got a lot on my mind and I don't have the time. And besides that, I'm in a bad mood. His dad said,
listen to me. You better do what I say, if you know what is good for you.
'Cause if you don't, if you won't, why, there's no telling what I might do. said, gee, hi, boss. What a surprise. Tell me, what are you doing here? His boss said, let's go. Need you at work right now. You can get in the car. Jamie's dad said, but boss, this is my day off. His boss said, don't push me too far. His boss said, listen to me. You better do what I say. You know what is good for you. If you don't, if you won't, why there's no telling what I might do. All of a sudden, a roar from above took all of them by surprise. They looked up to see, they could not believe a spaceship hovering up in the sky. A voice called out, all of you earthlings, all of you sniveling ants, get your shells out of town because we're coming down, giving you one last. At his dad's boss, nobody knew what to do. He looked up at the spaceship hovering above and the ants down below by his shoes. He got down on his knees and he said to the ants, I can see that you don't want to drown. He said, I don't know about the rest of these guys, but I'm putting my bucket down. Jamie said, listen to me. Cause I'm big, it doesn't figure that you have to listen to me. Jamie said,
listen to me, if you do what you want, I think I'd find you sound.
Just cause I'm bigger, it doesn't figure that I can push you around.
So we ended there with Bill Harley, and just because you're bigger, just because I'm bigger, it doesn't figure that I get to push you around, right? So today's show has been all about, you know, what part of the brain are we going to listen to? Are we going to listen to our reptile brain that wants to have some kind of chicken pecking order where the biggest ones win and the smallest ones lose? And that's just the way it is. Or do we want to listen to our thinking brain? Well, that takes practice, and that's what we've been practicing here on Amy's Kids Show. We're going to continue to practice using our thinking brains so we can make wiser decisions and having a great time, because when we're healthier, we're happier, and when we're happier, we're having more fun. So I hope you all have a fantastical weekend. Have fun out there, guys. Enjoy the last weekend of summer, because starting next week, it's going to be fall officially up here in the Northeast. And I hope y'all are having a great time. See you next week. Thanks for joining me for Amy's Kids Show.
We've had a great time here in Vermont.